listening to Harris Smith Radio, episode 13. Hey there, I'm your host, Wayne McPhail. This episode features a return visit from Harris Smith's resident handyman from Manitoulin Island, Steve Maxwell. This time out, Steve offers some good and timely advice about how to keep your house warm in the winter. Our old furnace doesn't want to hear the news. Next up, another timely topic, birdseed. I visit with Barry Bogle, who runs a seed business on equipment his grandfather would recognize. 10-pound bag of seeds? That's for punters. By the way, if you want to read Harris Smith Magazine instead of listen to it, you can subscribe to the print version online at harrissmithmagazine.com. And you can find Harris Smith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. But for now, settle in for the next half hour of Harris Smith Radio. If you're like me and live in an old house, you're going to want to listen to this. Steve Maxwell's sage advice on sealing out the winter winds and devilish drafts of this cold season. And we get into the advantages of chucking your old furnace, like the one right below my feet. Sorry, old friend. Here's our warming conversation. Last time we talked about getting off the grid, this time I want to talk about winterizing your place. And I want to talk about it from a number of point of view, from like windows and attics and standards and all that stuff. So let's talk about, first of all, what the easy wins, the low-hanging fruit are for people who want to really conserve energy in their home.
It's a great question because energy costs are high. They're not going to get any cheaper anytime soon, and they'll probably rise. The lowest hanging fruit for most people is pretty boring, really, and it has to do with attic insulation. Most homes in Canada would benefit from more insulation in the attic. It's also the easiest insulation to add to your home if you have a conventional attic, not a finished living space, but just a place with a bunch of pink stuff on the floor and webs of wood holding up the roof. If you've got an attic like that, having enough insulation there matters a lot, and it's easy to upgrade. So rule of thumb for most places in Canada, 22 inches in the attic would not be excessive.
Wow.
This exceeds code requirements in some places, but you have to understand that building codes are always minimum standards. They're not maximum standards. They have nothing whatsoever to do with what's economically viable or anything. It's just a kind of standard that has been set, a minimum standard that's been set for various parameters, including insulation. Well, I was just remembering a story. A man I know spent his whole career blowing insulation into attics, and he often ran into homes, not particularly old homes either, that were massively under-insulated in the attic. So he got to the point where he would, if he ran into a reluctant homeowner, he'd say, well, listen, I will give you this insulation for free. I mean, it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing, but I will give you this insulation for free if you give me the saving that it triggers for you. Because he knows that in every single situation, it's a paying investment. For a lot of houses, you blow in $1,000 of insulation, $1,500 of insulation, and if your home is not well insulated now, you're basically going to be saving an amount of money that would send you on a tropical vacation for a week once a year.
Wow, that's amazing.
That's kind of the magnitude, yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned the standards are sort of minimal standards, and older homes aren't necessarily up to code anyway. So you've got a situation where there's thousands, maybe millions of homes in Canada that either the code is just giving them the bare minimum, or they don't even have that because it's an old house, right?
Well, exactly. I mean, when we talk about building code standards, that doesn't mean that an older home has to be kept up to these standards. The standard is only what's required when the home is being constructed. So it's not too much to say that there are millions of homes in Canada that are under-insulated. You know, it's not just a matter of saving money, although that is a prime and worthy consideration, but it's also about comfort. For instance, if you have your thermostat set to 20 degrees Celsius inside and your home is not well insulated, you can have 20 degrees and your furnace is working hard to make that happen. But you're not going to be as comfortable as if you're in a home that's well insulated, that's heated to 20 degrees. And the difference is because the poorly insulated home is going to have cold spots When I say it's 20 degrees, it's 20 degrees at the thermostat, but across the room, you know, next to that big old poorly performing window, it's going to be considerably cooler. Or there could be drafts in places, too, or, you know, the upstairs could be very cold. Comfort is part of the equation, too, not just saving money.
Right. So it's like in the past, it would be everybody gather around the fireplace. These days, it's gather around the thermostat because it's
right.
Right.
Exactly.
So let's talk about windows and drafts. What should people think about when they're thinking about possibly replacing their windows? Because there's a wide range. I mean, we recently replaced our windows, and we could have spent anywhere from, you know, $35,000 down to $6,000 to replace the window. So what should people be considering?
The first thing, of course, is performance. And every window manufacturer has great windows, right? Or so they say. But what you really need to look at is an independent standard. And the best independent standard that I know of for assessing windows in Canada is an organization called WindowWise. So windowwise.ca. If you type that in, it's going to take you to an independent organization that verifies the effectiveness of windows, so the technical effectiveness, so how well they seal out drafts, what their insulation level is, how well they resist wind-driven rain. All of these things are features that you can't know ahead of time when you're in a showroom or looking at a brochure. So the WindowWise people, they, as far as technical verification goes, they have a list with windows that meet something called the A440 standard. So this is a CSA standard, Canadian Standards Association. Windows on the list have been tested in a lab, and they meet certain minimum standards. That's a great place to start. You also need to recognize something. I mean, really bad windows are easy to spot. You know, you might have some curtains in front of the windows, and if they move when it's windy outside, you know, there's a lot of gains to be made by replacing those windows. But other times, you know, you have to ask yourself, well, is my window worth changing or not? I mean, what should I do? Part of the answer to that question comes down to how well the windows are working. Are they opening and closing well? Are they still functioning properly? What kind of glass do you have in the window? If you've got a modern double-pane glass arrangement in your current windows now, and they're not fogging up, or there's not a whole lot of condensation on the inside, then chances are the windows you have aren't all that bad. Now, there are gains to be made by replacing them, but you don't want to replace windows that are still decent unnecessarily, because even cheap windows are fairly expensive. And like you mentioned, you can also spend a lot on windows, too. So the WindowWise people, besides publishing a list of approved window models, they also have tradespeople that have been trained and certified in window installation. And that's important because you can have the world's greatest window, but if it's not installed properly, it's not going to perform properly. If it's not sealed into the building structure, you can still have drafts. And drafts around a great window, I mean, you might as well have a bad window if that's what you've got. And there's also the issue of doing the window replacement so the job looks nice. It's actually fairly tricky. You know, you've got to be careful about removing the old window, preserving the existing trim if that's the approach you're going to take. You definitely don't want to just turn this job over to someone who seems nice on the phone. You need to do a little bit of research and get the good stuff.
So if we've now talked about insulating the attic and having like 22 inches blown in there or laid in there, placing windows with windows that are actually going to seal and don't produce drafts. And that those are sort of the two things in terms of heat loss. Let's talk about heat production in a minute in terms of the furnace. But what else in terms of heat loss should people be paying attention to?
Basements. Actually, that would be something that's very important, too. Imagine you've got an unfinished basement, just masonry walls. Perhaps those masonry walls are sticking up above the ground, you know, 2 or 3 feet. Insulating those walls is going to make a big difference to the energy consumption of your home. Because a lot of heat can be lost through uninsulated basement walls. Currently, the code requirement is for, usually, in most places, for basements, new basements to be insulated to a certain level. And builders are getting better at doing that. These insulating blankets that you see installed in new basements where they have the fiber-based bat insulation sandwiched within a polyethylene bag to prevent condensation. Those are effective, and we're seeing that more and more in newer houses. But it wasn't that long ago that houses didn't require any insulation in the basement, or maybe only on the top half of the wall. So lots of basements could be improved with insulation. I would offer a warning, though. When people think about insulating basements, they think, oh, okay, well, I was thinking of finishing the basement, so insulating the walls are going to be part of that. The standard method of insulating basement, of finishing basements now, exterior basement walls, where you put a stud frame wall against the masonry wall and you insulate it with bat insulation and put drywall on the inside. That's the standard approach for above ground walls, and it's still used plenty below ground. But the problem is that arrangement is very, very susceptible to moisture damage and mold growth. So when I coach people on finishing their basements, I always say never do the wood frame stud wall in the basement with fiber-based insulation, because it might work, but chances are excellent that you're just basically building, it's almost like a compost pile around the walls of your basement. So many basements that smell musty, that's the cause, and there's no fix for it. After you've got that built, there's no fix for it. So it can affect the indoor air quality throughout your whole home. So a far better way of insulating basement walls is with a system that is at least a little bit impervious to water. So some rigid foam. There are some insulating basement panels which have 4 inches of insulation and drywall built right in, and you put these panels up. They don't even touch the outside wall. There's a space between the masonry wall and the panel. It does a great job, and it's going to preserve your indoor air quality too.
So speaking of basements, let's flip it around and talk about heat. What should people be thinking about? And we've talked, you were just talking about masonry walls and stuff, and you keep describing my house, right? These crappy insulation in the walls and the ceiling and masonry basement that doesn't have insulation in it. I'm feeling really bad. But staying in the basement, and we have an old furnace as well. So let's stay with that. And talk to me about what people should be thinking about whether they should replace their furnace and how they should replace their furnace.
Well, that's a great question, because it's crucial to making your home as efficient as it can be. Right now, and probably for the foreseeable future, the most economical energy source you can choose for home heating would be natural gas. Canada's got lots of natural gas. We're a net exporter of it. We have at least 300 years reserves in this country. So, and it's also very inexpensive because it's delivered in an automated way. I mean, there's natural gas pipelines leading to homes in cities and suburban areas. It is by far the cheapest option. And that's really the first decision you have to make. Not so much should I change my furnace, but what energy source will I use? Because a furnace or a heating system, All it really is an energy conversion technology. It's taking energy in the form of some kind of a heating fuel, and it's converting it into heat and distributing it to your house. So what's the best energy source to start with? Natural gas, that's a no-brainer when you have it, when you can get it. Now, things get more complicated, though, when you get out of range of the natural gas pipeline, and now you've got to choose options that can be delivered to your site. So that might be propane, and that has been oil traditionally. Electricity was also very popular for things like that. Now, I'm talking about options that don't have to do with what I call DIY heat, which might be a wood stove or something like that. We just set that aside for a minute. But in terms of a conventional automatic heating system, you need to decide on the energy source, and then you decide on the equipment. Now, should you change your furnace? Well, that really comes down to how old the furnace is that you've got now and what you know about the efficiency level. So I think the oldest you'll ever see a furnace lasting is about 25 years. If you get to 20 years and things are still working fine, you're heating on borrowed time. So age is part of it. Also, how well is it working? If you have a 15-year-old furnace and a $100 problem crops up that needs to be fixed, I say fix the 15-year-old furnace in all likelihood. But if a $1,000 repair bill comes in, well, I think it's time to start looking for a new furnace. It's a bit of a judgment call, but it really has to do with how much life the furnace has left. Another issue, and this might take a little more homework, but is to determine how efficient your current system is. Now, you mentioned a furnace. Most houses in Canada are heated with some kind of a furnace. and it has an efficiency rating. And by that, I mean it's a percentage of the amount of energy that is being consumed versus the amount of energy that's actually being delivered to your home. In the olden days, your standard low-efficiency gas furnace from the 1970s, say, or 60s, that would be running at an efficiency of maybe 65%. 35% of the heat that you pay for went up the chimney, and that was just the way it was back then. Nowadays, you know, we have some very efficient units. We have condensing, modulating boilers, for instance. They can suck out about 95, 96% of the energy that goes into them will result in heat to your home. So if you have a furnace that is, oh, I don't know, 15 or 20 years old, and it was maybe a medium efficiency unit at the time, so maybe 80, 85% efficient, it probably makes sense to upgrade to something in the 90% range. So it's a matter of age, and it's also a matter of the efficiency of what you've got now. Because if you've already got a unit that is 10, 15 years old, and it's already one of those 95% units, and it's continuing to work fine, well, let it go for a while and see how much you can get out of it. But it's surprising how fast a new furnace will pay for itself in energy savings. And if you go from an 80% efficient unit to a 95% efficient unit, it won't be that many years before you've basically paid for your new furnace, and the rest of the savings is just gravy.
So I want to touch on the idea of efficiency. And you mentioned wood stoves and wood pellet stoves and stuff. And I think that we'll save that for another conversation, because I'd love to get into that in a lot of detail. But I just want to end off with the idea of something that you've mentioned in some of your writings, with the idea of moving towards a sort of a zero energy house and in terms of energy efficiency. And can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Most people are surprised to learn that it is technically possible to build a house that uses zero net energy. So that means that the amount of energy consumed, the total amount consumed by the house for all purposes, is the same as or less than the energy produced on the property through alternative methods, so wind and solar. What happens here, by making the house very efficient, and by including some alternate energy production, it is possible to have a home with zero energy bill. Now, that seems incredible, because we've been raised with energy bills. I mean, that's just the way it is. It seems kind of unbelievable that there could be any alternative. But there is. And in fact, code authorities around the world are pushing the home building industry in that direction, with the ultimate goal of someday every new house fitting into the zero energy model. As I said, that seems incredible, but I'll tell you a story about a man that I know in Toronto. He's a contractor. He's been a contractor for 30 years, and he decided he wanted to pull out all the stops and make himself the most efficient home that he could. So he took a bungalow in North York, built in the 1950s, and he tore a lot of it down. He retained the foundation and some of the walls, but he basically created the best possible energy-efficient home he could on that site. So he moves in January. His energy bill for January, the first month, and he's since done modifications that even improve the energy efficiency, his total energy bill was $20 for January. Wow. Now, you might say, well, yeah, but how much did it cost him to build that place? I know this man well, and he told me that he's a contractor. He knows how much things cost. He's built other places before. He says the cost was not significantly higher than the conventional way of building. What was significantly different, though, was the way he used really high-end products like certain kinds of green spray foam, for instance, environmentally sound spray foam, other techniques. He has an evacuated tube solar collector on his roof, so he's generating energy on site, and other methods for ventilation and preserving energy. He did have a real struggle with the tradespeople he was working with, because he was asking them to do things they had never done before.
Right.
And that was the biggest struggle of the project. Well, that actually, and getting approval from the building authority in North York to allow him to do this. And he was just about to give up. I was writing a Toronto Star column at the time, a weekly column, about home building. And so I wrote about his plight. And that actually changed the situation for him. He got his approvals, And he went ahead, and now his home is actually so energy efficient that it attracts visitors internationally. He has hosted a number of visits to his house where he actually shows how he has done everything to get this near zero energy home built and working in the real world.
Well, that's amazing. And I should remind folks that are listening to this podcast that Steve and I talked about getting off the grid or getting energy from solar and wind to offset some of the costs to heat a place in a previous podcast. So you can go back and listen to that if you want to get more detail about that. And Steve, thanks for sharing your information about keeping warm in the winter, winterizing, keeping an economic view of heating your place and sealing your place in such a way that you're not going to get mold, but you're also going to get warm and you don't have to huddle around the thermostat in the middle of the winter to tell stories.
Very good. My pleasure.
That was Steve Maxwell, warm and cozy in Northern Ontario. Barry Bogle's grandfather bought a farm in Flamborough, Ontario in 1874. Back then, he raised bees. These days, Barry grows plants for seed. Birdseed, mostly. He runs the operation out of a barn filled with ancient but admirable equipment, some of which his grandfather would recognize. Join me on a soundscape tour of Bogle Seeds, where a 50-pound bag of sunflower seeds is small potatoes, and the grain silos and feeder tubes loom like benign giants.
Originally, this farm would be, subsistence, trying to make a living in those days. My grandfather, back in the 1900s, was into bees. Then they branched into potatoes and egg-laying hens. And then we eventually, about 1970, we went into the wild bird seed business.
Right. And you were growing what kind of seeds back then?
Back then, you'd be growing oats and red clover for seed and stuff like that. But once we got into the bird seed business and we started growing the oats, corn, millet, sunflowers was I guess we were the first grower of sunflowers in Ontario, and at present we're the largest grower continuously growing sunflowers in Ontario.
And how many acres have you got here?
This is a 100-acre farm, and then we rent some properties, and so we're working a little over 250 acres, which in today's standards isn't very much, but because we're so specialized with the wild bird seed and everything like that, it is quite a lot more work than just growing a field of corn or a field of soybeans, right, or something.
And the majority of your sales is coming from individuals arriving here just to buy seed for their homes, right?
Yes, that's correct. We do wholesale a very small portion of our crop to other stores and stuff, but I would say 98% of our sales are direct from the barn here on 6 days a week. Right. We get one day off for Sunday.
Right. And you also sell some feed for geese and deer as well?
Yeah, we sell whole corn, which we run through the seed cleaner behind me here. It's all nice and clean and everything, and it goes for deer and trumpeter swans and geese and all the different critters in the wintertime that like the larger seeds.
Right. And what changes have you seen in the industry over the past several years?
Well, when we first started doing this, we were kind of like the only game in town. Right. But since that, like every corner store sells wild bird seed, and it makes it a little tougher maybe. Mm-hmm. But because we are so much cheaper, we have a very loyal clientele, right, that keep coming back.
And you don't have as much filler. You were telling me about the different kinds of seeds that birds don't like and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of the mixes out there have wheat and milo in them. Birds will not eat wheat and milo. It's put in as a filler, the same as what they're doing now with the gravel. They put bird grit in the mixes. And like Ontario has lots of bird grit, yeah, and gravel in the laneways and wherever. So we don't need to be buying and selling gravel.
I said, Barry, show me around a bit here. What do we got going here?
Okay, this is our main seed cleaner where we clean all our seed. All the garbage goes out the back, and the good seed goes into the storage bins over farther. Right. We'll see maybe them later. This is the bagger we use for taking off the seed. Right now we've been doing corn, and it takes out all the chaff and the cobs and stuff.
And what's sitting in behind there? You've got all of these pipes coming down in here.
Yeah, so this is an elevator leg that takes all the grain to the top, and then it distributes it from there into different sections of the seed cleaner.
Right.
The red thing up there is for taking the tails off of oats, so the oats become very heavy for horse feed.
Right.
And we do sell quite a lot of our seed, too, for horses and for other livestock as well. We don't just specialize in bird seed, but a little bit of everything.
Okay.
Most of our equipment is relatively old, but it keeps running. We don't spend a lot on newfangled equipment, and therefore we can sell cheaper, too, our product. Where we mix the bird seed and the different types of farm feeds, which are mixed of different grains. You can maybe see all the different augers. Each auger comes out of a different grain tank. I think there's 9 different grain tanks up here that hold the clean product. We then weigh them off onto the scales here, and they run into this old mixer, which still works just as good as the day it was built, and probably back in the 40s.
Now, I was looking before at this thing overhead here. What is that up there?
It's called a rack lifter. Now, the platform that you see is the deck of a wagon, and they would take that wagon to the field and load it up with sheaves. They would then bring it in the barn, and a horse would pull the wagon top and load all the way up to the top of the barn, and the old farmers up there up on top would then fork it over to the side of the barn, and they could fill it right to the ceiling, right to the roof.
That was Barry Bogle from his seed farm in Flamborough, Ontario. So, here we are at the end of this episode of Harrismith Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to this podcast on Apple iTunes or in your favorite podcast player. And please, tell your friends and family. Got feedback? We'd love to hear it. You can email us at letters@harrismithmag.com. That URL, harrismithmag.com, is also where you can order subscriptions online. And you can find Harrismith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. Until next time, for Harrismith Radio, I'm Wayne McPhail. And also, until next time, remember these 4 words: make, grow, sustain, share. Tune in for the next episode of Harrismith Radio.